Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. This is Book 11, Chapter XIX. Kutuzov's order to retreat through Moscow to the Ryazan Road was issued at night on the 1st of September. The first troops started at once, and during the night they marched slowly and steadily without hurry. At daybreak, however, those nearing the town at the Dorogomilov Bridge saw ahead of them masses of soldiers crowding and hurrying across the bridge, ascending on the opposite side and blocking the streets and alleys, while endless masses of troops were bearing down on them from behind, and an unreasoning hurry and alarm overcame them. They all rushed forward to the bridge, onto it, and to the fords and to the boats. Kutuzov himself had driven round by side streets to the other side of Moscow. By 10 o'clock in the morning of the 2nd of September, only the rear guard remained in the Dorogomilov suburb, where they had ample room. The main army was on the other side of Moscow, or beyond it. At that very time, at 10 in the morning of the 2nd of September, Napoleon was standing among his troops on the Poklonny Hill, looking at the panorama spread out before him. From the 26th of August to the 2nd of September, that is, from the Battle of Borodino to the entry of the French into Moscow, during the whole of that agitating, memorable week, there had been the extraordinary autumn weather that always comes as a surprise, when the sun hangs low and gives more heat than in spring, when everything shines so brightly in the rare, clear atmosphere that the eyes are smart, when the lungs are strengthened and refreshed by inhaling the aromatic autumn air, when even the nights are warm, and when in those dark, warm nights golden stars startle and delight us continually by falling from the sky. At 10 in the morning of the 2nd of September, this weather still held. The brightness of the morning was magical. Moscow, seen from the Poklonny Hill, lay spaciously spread out, with her river, her gardens, and her churches, and she seemed to be living her usual life, her cupolas glittering like stars in the sunlight. The view of the strange city, with its peculiar architecture, such as he had never seen before, filled Napoleon with the rather envious and uneasy curiosity men feel when they see an alien form of life that has no knowledge of them. This city was evidently living with the full force of its own life. By the indefinite signs which, even at a distance, distinguish a living body from a dead one, Napoleon, from the Poklonny Hill, perceived the throb of life in the town, and felt, as it were, the breathing of that great and beautiful body. Every Russian looking at Moscow feels her to be a mother. Every foreigner who sees her, even if ignorant of her significance as the mother city, must feel her feminine character, and Napoleon felt it. Cette ville ascétique aux énormes brilles églises Moscou la Sainte. La voilà donc, enfin, cette fameuse ville, il était temps, said he, which translates to that Asiatic town of the innumerable churches, holy Moscow. Here it is then, at last, that famous town. It was high time. And dismounting, he ordered a plan of Moscow to be spread out before him, and summoned Lelorange de Idylville, the interpreter. A town captured by the enemy is like a maid who has lost her honour, thought he. He said so to Tukov at Smolensk. From that point of view, he glazed at the oriental beauty he had not seen before. It seemed strange to him that his long-felt wish, which had seemed unattainable, had at last been realized. In the clear morning light, he gazed now at the city and now at the plan, considering its details, and the assurance of possessing it agitated and awed him. But could it be otherwise? He thought. Here is this capital at my feet. Where is Alexander now? And of what is he thinking? A strange, beautiful, majestic city, and a strange and majestic moment. In what light must I appear to them? He thought, thinking of his troops. Here she is, the reward for all those faint-hearted men, he reflected, glancing at those near him and at the troops who were approaching and forming up. One word from me, one movement of my hand in that ancient capital of the Tsars would perish. But my clemency is always ready to descend upon the vanquished. I must be magnanimous and truly great. But no, it can't be true that I am in Moscow, he suddenly thought. Yet here she is lying at my feet, with her golden domes and crosses scintillating and twinkling in the sunshine. But I shall spare her. On the ancient monuments of barbarism and despotism, I will inscribe great words of justice and mercy. It is just this which Alexander will feel most painfully. I know him. It seemed to Napoleon that the chief import of what was taking place lay in the personal struggle between himself and Alexander. From the height of the Kremlin, yes, there is the Kremlin, yes, I will give them just laws. I will teach them the meaning of true civilization. I will make generations of boyars remember their conqueror with love. The footnote says, in ancient and medieval Russia, the boyars were the chief assistants of the Tsars. The class and title were abolished by Peter I, and the last of the boyars died in 1750. Napoleon's repeated use of the word is meant to indicate the superficiality of his knowledge of Russia. I will tell the deputation that I did not and do not desire war, that I have waged war only against the false policy of their court, and I love and respect Alexander, and that in Moscow I will accept terms of peace worthy of myself and of my people. I do not wish to utilize the fortunes of war to humiliate an honored monarch. Boyars, I will say to them, I do not desire war. I desire the peace and welfare of all my subjects. However, I know their presence will inspire me, and I shall speak to them as I always do, clearly, impressively, and majestically. But can it be true that I am in Moscow? Yes, there she lies. Kuomon mermi le boyars, said he to his suite, which means, let the boyars be brought to me. A general with a brilliant suit galloped off at once to fetch the boyars. 2 hours passed. Napoleon lunched, and was again standing in the same place on the Poklonny Hill, awaiting the deputation. His speech to the boyars had already taken definite shape in his imagination. That speech was full of dignity and greatness as Napoleon understood it. He was himself carried away by the tone of magnanimity he intended to adopt towards Moscow. In imagination he appointed days for assemblies at the palace of the Tsars, at which Russian notables and his own would mingle. He mentally appointed a governor, one who would win the hearts of the people. Having learnt that there were many charitable institutions in Moscow, he mentally decided that he would shower favours on all of them. He thought that, as in Africa, he had had to put on burnous and sit in a mosque, so at Moscow he must be beneficent like the Tsars. And in order, finally, to touch the hearts of the Russians, and being, like all Frenchmen, unable to imagine anything sentimental without a reference to Ma Cherie, Ma Tendre, Ma Premier, which is My Dear, My Tender, My Poor Mother, he decided that he would place an inscription on all these establishments in large letters. This establishment is dedicated to my dear mother. Or no, it should be simply Maison de ma mère, he concluded, which says House of my mother. But am I really in Moscow? Yes, here it lies before me. But why is the deputation from the city so long in appearing? He wondered. Meanwhile, an agitated consultation was being carried on in whispers among the generals and marshals at the rear of his suite. Those sent to fetch the deputation had returned with the news that Moscow was empty, that everyone had left it. The faces of those who were conferring together were pale and perturbed. They were not alarmed by the fact that Moscow had been abandoned by its inhabitants, grave as that fact seemed, but by the question how to tell the emperor, without putting him in a terrible position of appearing ridiculous, that he had been awaiting the boyars so long in vain, that there were drunken mobs left in Moscow, but no one else. Some said that a deputation of some sort must be scraped together. Others disputed that opinion, and maintained that the emperor should first be carefully and skillfully prepared, and then told the truth. "He will have to be told all the same," said some gentlemen of the suite. "But, gentlemen," the position was the more awkward because the emperor, meditating upon his magnanimous plans, was pacing patiently up and down before the outspread map, occasionally glancing along the road to Moscow from under his lifted hand with a bright and proud smile. "But it's impossible," declared the gentlemen of the suite, shrugging their shoulders but not venturing to utter the implied word, "le ridicule." At last the emperor tired of futile expectation, his actor's instinct suggesting to him that this sublime moment, having been too long drawn out, was beginning to lose its sublimity, gave a sign with his hand. A single report of a signalling gun followed, and the troops, who were already spread out on different sides of Moscow, moved into the city through the Tver, Kaluga, and the Dorogomolov gates. Faster and faster, vying with one another, they moved at the double or at a trot. Vanishing amid the clouds of dust they raised and making the air ring with a deafening roar of mingling shouts. Drawn on by the movement of his troops, Napoleon rode with them as far as the Dorogomolov gate, but there again stopped and, dismounting from his horse, paced for a long time by the Kamakolsky rampart awaiting the deputation. Alright, there we go. Another chapter down, and it seems like Napoleon has arrived in an abandoned Moscow. It was quite vivid the way it was described, standing at the foot of a beautiful, and I think the word majestic was used, majestic city, and trying to wrap your head around, "This is my city now." Which is something I'm sure no one will ever feel. No one listening to this, at least, to take over a city. You know, I don't think that'll happen anymore, really. But I suppose that's what used to happen. You would overthrow a city and it would be yours. And that's Napoleon standing at Moscow and thinking, "Is this mine now? What's going on?" What a weird feeling. And that sort of feeling of like, an alien sort of thing, you know, to so many people, so many Russian people, that city is home, and it's, if it's not their actual home, it's like their mother city. They're so familiar with it and have that deep connection with it, and then you are standing at this city which would just seem so strange, but also it has that maternal feeling to it, like this is someone else's mother city. I don't know, it was eerie sort of feeling, but I think Tolstoy really captured it really quite well in this chapter. Chatelvelster said, "This chapter focuses mainly on Napoleon's thoughts while looking at Moscow and awaiting the deputation. What's your opinion on his thoughts? Did it change in any way how you're looking at him now?" Mellow Yellow said, "This chapter didn't change my opinion or thoughts about Napoleon, but solidified them. Napoleon is pompous and self-aggrandizing. It was a bit amusing whenever he would doubt that he was actually in Moscow because a Russian delegation hasn't yet come up to meet him." Also, this chapter, specifically the beginning, where the Russian retreat and Napoleon on top of Poklonaya Hill are described, has given me a surprising desire to visit Moscow. Before this chapter, I've never had a lot of a consideration to visit Russia, let alone Moscow. And now I want to see the view from Poklonaya Hill, explore the Victory Park and the War Museum that sits atop it, and walk through the Dorogomilovskaya neighborhood and visit the Kremlin and the Red Square. JP said, I tried in vain to find some photos of the Kremlin from Poklonaya Hill. I think they leveled it somewhat to build the museum that is there. Plus the smog and growth of the city sounds 1812 obscures the vista somewhat. If anyone finds a better photo of the view Napoleon may have, please send it to me. Yeah, that would be a cool photo to see. Unfortunately, no one's responded. But if we get a response to that, I'd love to see that as well. One cool thing that I've seen, I tried to Google images of the Kremlin in 1812, and it keeps coming up with pictures of the Museum of the War of 1812, which is a museum in Moscow dedicated to the very war that we're reading about at the moment. So it is a significant part of the history of Moscow, which was already obvious, but I didn't realize there's a huge building which is just dedicated to preserving this moment in history that we're reading now. If you Google image search Kremlin 1800s, you can also get a little bit of an idea of the city that that Napoleon is about to take. It's quite interesting. Alright, that's going to do us for today's chapter. Thank you very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.